Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to Blog Talk Radio with Centria of Eddie's Wellness and Resource Center. Today we will have with us Mr. Todd Marcus. Mr. Todd Marcus has released a brand new CD, and he will be having a concert series this week, and he will be here in Baltimore on this Saturday, June 16th at 8 p.m. at Baltimore Center Stage. Mr. Marcus, how are you today?
Doing good. Good to be with you.
Good. So, Mr. Marcus, not only have you released a new CD, but you also are an advocate in the community. And one of the things that we like to do here on this segment is let people know about the things that are going on in the community that can be a resource to them. So could you introduce us to your community nonprofit Intersection of Change? How long
Sure.
have you been around?
Intersection of Change is a community-based nonprofit here in West Baltimore. We're right on Pennsylvania Avenue. We border the Sandtown, Winchester, and Upton communities. And we were founded in 1996 by a lifelong community resident named Elder C.W. Harris. And I met him that same year, actually. And he and I and his wife, Mrs. Harris, really worked from that beginning point to build things from the ground, literally, because he in that year had acquired a vacant building that we started working on renovating, and the whole intersection was abandoned and vacant. And we worked over these many years to reclaim all the vacant buildings and make them into spaces that address poverty-related challenges in our community, and that's our mission at Intersection of Change. And so we do that with three different programs that we operate. One is a recovery program for our women overcoming substance abuse and homelessness, and that's called Martha's Place. And our second program that we started in 2008 is called Jubilee Arts, which offers arts classes all week and entrepreneurial business classes, community projects like murals and beautification projects. And then most recently, we added on the Strength to Love 2 program, which serves our ex-offenders in the neighborhood with employment at a farm we run here in our community. So we've got a lot going on, and like I said, it's all in service of our mission of addressing poverty-related challenges here in our neighborhood.
Okay, and do you reach out to youth for specific community activities in particular, or is it open to everyone of any age? So is there a particular focus group that you work best with, that you found that your programs really assist with the most?
Well, one of the things that's unique about us is that we very much are community-based. And I mentioned Elder Harris being a lifelong community resident, as well as his wife. And then you got folks like me that are not from the neighborhood originally, but as part of kind of our value system, move in to be a permanent part of the community. And that's over 20 years for me now. And so our focus really is on addressing the needs specifically of our neighborhood here. And so our priority is on our community residents. So that is always our focus. But In addition to that, we have folks from throughout the city and sometimes throughout the state that that participate in the programs that we offer. So so that's kind of our approach: community first, and then but engaging others as there is interest and need.
Okay, and it doesn't matter how old or how young you are welcome to come.
Oh yeah, because we have kids in our Jubilee Arts program, I think as young as six. And ladies in our Martha's Place program have ranged from 19 into their 60s. And then at the top end, some of the senior citizens in our Jubilee Arts classes are, in their 70s and 80s. So we serve all range of our neighborhood and the city.
Okay. That's good. So now I want to turn our attention and focus over to your new CD. And we'll come back and give everyone more information on how to get in contact with you at the end, so that people are paying attention to that at that time. But right now I want to go ahead and get into what inspired you to create this CD, and what are you trying to share with the people through this CD? What message do you have in this particular release?
Well, for me, this CD is a special one because it merges the two halves of my life as a community activist here in our neighborhood and as a musician.
Mm-hmm.
And having those two halves, in 2015, after we had the unrest here in Baltimore, after the death of Freddie Gray, and a lot of that was focused here in our neighborhood in Sandtown, Winchester, and Upton. And Freddie Gray lived in Sandtown, Winchester, here in our neighborhood, about four blocks mm-hmm. from my house, and so I didn't know him, but that's part of our neighborhood, and it would be the unrest was strongly felt here in our community. A lot of the activity of that night of the unrest was at Pennsylvania Avenue and North Avenue, as well as a lot of the peaceful demonstrations and the days and weeks after that. And so for me, you know, I was thinking about this very much around that time and just watching the news coverage and seeing how, as is so common, media focuses on the negative. And we're right. a neighborhood that already is used to the negative stereotypes about us.
Mm-hmm.
With folks, negatives, and a lot of that focuses on the challenge we have, whether they're crime-related or some of the addiction challenges we have. And for us, though, living in the community, we know the challenge we have, but we also know the positives, and that's the majority of things that does not get covered by media and that people outside our neighborhood don't have understand. And that's where I felt that as a community resident and as an artist, it was an opportunity for me to create some art, some music that try to capture mm-hmm. the full scope of our community, our strengths as well as our challenges. And so that's
right.
what prompted me to start trying to write different pieces of music that would capture these different qualities that we have here.
Okay. That's one of the things I was even thinking about before we came on today, was how Baltimore in and of itself is perceived a lot of the time. And as I'm doing these segments, and I'm speaking to all these great people who are doing things in the community or in Baltimore or even just in the state in general, reaching out to people, it's hard for me to even watch the news. Like, I rarely ever even watch the news. Most of the news I catch now is Facebook news,
mm-hmm.
Where someone is reposting something that they thought was interesting or you know, important at the time, because we are not represented properly. People do not get to see all of the good. People don't get to see people like you who are making an imprint in the community and the impact of that over time, because it does take time. You're affecting each generation in its own way, and then that in turn will create something different in the future, over the next 10 years, because it takes about a decade anyway for you to see change the way that you want to. But those things get overlooked too often, and I really appreciate you doing what you do. I appreciate us being able to sit down here today and even have this conversation and bring this part of Baltimore to the attention of others, because this particular segment and this particular network can be listened to and has been listened to from people all over the world. And I can recall when I went to the Bahamas for a friend of mine just for his mom's birthday. And I was sitting at the counter, and a young lady, we were conversing. She was a bartender. And first thing she asked me is, how are things going in Baltimore? You know, we saw all of that going on. Like, is it really that bad? And I'm like, no, it's not. Every place has its challenges. And she was like, yeah, I thought it might be a little overblown, but you never know till you ask, you know, because they do like to portray especially people of color, you know, in such a negative light a lot. So
right.
She was like, that's really good to know. But it's just amazing the imbalance in the and what the children get to see. And that's why I asked specifically about children being in your program, because what they see and what they in what they come in contact with on a daily basis is what's going to shape what happens over the next few years as far as our crime rate, as far as people going into this music, which I think is, I think the jazz, because it's so varied, there's so many different genres to it, is something that anyone, regardless of what kind of music you claim that you love, can participate in and enjoy. I know that you pretty much focus on straight ahead, but what other forms of jazz have you encountered or practiced yourself or participated in? And what has been your experience with youth and the various forms of jazz that are out here, and where do you see that going?
Well, I'd say that I've paid attention to all the different styles of jazz. One of the first exposures that I had was to New Orleans style of jazz. When I was in high school, there was an English teacher, and I came to learn that during the summers, he would go down to New Orleans, and for decades he had been doing that. And spent time in Presbyterian Hall, sitting and listening to a lot of the original musicians, and learning from them. And so that was a chance for me to start listening to music at that time period. And you know, that's something that I still enjoy listening to, and I'm very glad I had that exposure early on. Then you got all the lineage from that to bebop to the hard bop and John Coltrane and electric and fusion. And then I think what's interesting now is sometimes folks say, well, how is the music still evolving? What's taking place? And I think it definitely is still one of the things you've seen over the last couple of decades. I think more and more are people from different cultures and ethnicities infusing those influences into the music. And certainly it's not something completely new. John Coltrane was really renowned for doing that and incorporating African influences and Asian influences. And you think about the work of Stan Getz and Charlie Burge incorporating bossa nova, so you got the Latin rhythms, and then of course the whole Latin jazz scene from Cuba and Puerto Rico. So that's definitely a long history of that. But I think more and more you're seeing musicians now very intentionally incorporating some of their influences, like Indian musicians incorporating that specifically. Or in my case, I've worked to incorporate Middle Eastern influences because my dad was Egyptian. And so I started getting really intrigued with looking into my culture and that aspect of music and seeing how might I be able to fuse that into my jazz work. And I know there are a few other musicians out there, a couple trumpet players. One is an Iraqi trumpet player named Amir El Safar, and another gentleman who's half Lebanese and half French. You know, folks that are are looking to see, okay, how do we take this music that we love and have been playing and love it from the heyday of its glory years, but put something new of ourselves in there. And so that's some things that, mm-hmm. some ways that you've seen it happen.
So, and just to let everyone know, Todd had two other CDs out last year. And one of those CDs you let us in on your Egyptian heritage is called Inheritance. And the other was called Blues for Tahrir. Am I saying it, the name correct?
Tahrir, which is for Tahrir
okay.
Square in Egypt, in Cairo, which is where a lot of the demonstrations in Egypt's revolution in 2011 were centered.
Okay. And so we got to experience, those of us who were able to listen to those CDs, we got to hear some of those influences in that music. And will you be featuring a few of those pieces at this concert on Saturday, or will it only be the pieces from the new CD?
The concert this Saturday at Baltimore Center Stage will be specifically to focus on the new album, On These Streets.
Okay.
And so that is, that's the newest album that, like I said, really captures our community here. For me, it's that musical portrait of our neighborhood here. And so we're going to be playing all the music from that, as well as some of the interludes. Yes, but, you know, I still play music from the other albums, like when my the nine-piece group that I have, we did some performances in March, and so we still yet play that music and keep that alive as well.
Do you have any other music that we should know about aside from these three CDs that you've put maybe on? Because I know I found Inheritance on Spotify. Are there any other outlets that people can find your music on? And do you have anything aside from these three?
Yeah, my website, toddmarcusjazz.com, has all those outlets as far as, you know, we do CD Baby and Bandcamp and iTunes and Amazon. I made the choice not to do Spotify for this current album because, boy, you know, the financials of how they see the funds go to artists is so bleak. And I said, well, I don't feel like that's right for me. But you know, those other portals are where you can get my music. And again, on my website, you can see about the different CDs I have, as well as a lot of video footage of different ensembles. And my ensembles range from two musicians up to 10. And so some of my ensembles are featured on albums like the Jazz Orchestra, which is the large group, and is featured on Blues for Tahrir. But then you've also got some of my small ensembles like the Duo and Trio that I've got a body of work for them but have not recorded albums yet. So that's where visiting the website, folks can get information on the albums that have been recorded, as well as see video and audio of those that haven't been recorded yet.
Okay. It's interesting because when we were setting up for this, I remember saying, "Whether we want to talk about the music or the community work that you're doing." And honestly, I know when I said both, but really, that was the right thing because this whole CD is about the community. So there's no way we could have spoken today and not addressed the work that you're doing in the community, as this CD On the Streets is specifically about the community. So getting a little bit away from the logistics and the organization itself as it stands, what is your vision on a weekly basis for what you're doing? Like, what drives you to go out every day and say, you know what, I'm going to go here, I'm going to feed or invest in these people today, aside from what has been outlined you know, obviously what you've created, the community center, has its own guidelines, and you're going to follow those guidelines in accordance with what you have established there. But aside from that, what drives you to actually go ahead and continue a network?
Well, for me, it's very much a continued belief in our mission of serving our community from an approach that, as I was sharing earlier, is kind of like we talk about it as being a servant leader to our community.
Mm-hmm.
And that community-centered model, I think, is important because, you know, communities like ours that have struggled with poverty issues over the decades have had to contend with those struggles, with the challenges, and a lot of times also the awkward dynamics of having different groups or entities or government efforts that say we're going to do A, B, and C to try to serve the community and tell you what you need, and then something comes, whether it's a politician or a developer, and they're there temporarily, and then or there maybe there's an initiative, and then it comes and goes quickly, and the money dries up, and those maybe even well-attended efforts at times disappear. And so for us, being based here in our community for that long term, and if nothing else, being good neighbors, I think is an important starting point and foundation and philosophy for us, and it helps us, I think, do our work in a manner, like I said, that is from the standpoint of being a servant leader and being in tune with knowing what the needs are. Is definitely a social justice kind of approach to it. We come out of a faith tradition as well. And I think in my end, too, there's definitely that dynamic. When I was getting introduced to the neighborhood years ago when I was just coming as a volunteer, and then I started just learning about the community. And as I was getting into jazz as well and studying the heroes of mine, Miles Davis, Coltrane, Max Roach, Charlie Mingus, whose music was so intertwined with the social events of the 50s and 60s in our country. And for me, I felt very strongly about the social justice and the racial issues that were being confronted at that time. And, you know, getting involved in our neighborhood in the mid-90s, and looking at our country at that time, I felt very strongly that there was still the relevance of the need for us working as a country, and for me as an individual, on kind of this racial reconciliation, that we still have so much disparity and division along racial lines in our country. Unfortunately, still a lot of pain and racial and racism still in our country, and that I knew that for me, that was something that I felt strongly about wanting to be a part of reconciliation and healing. And I felt like, if nothing else, moving into the neighborhood, I could be a good neighbor. And so for me, I think that is still an important motivation and driving force. And I feel that 20 years later, that it kind of these last few years feel like we're kind of moving in the wrong direction along racial lines. There's been this surge of kind of white nationalism and even this white supremacist kind of perspectives that have frequently been emboldened. And so that's discouraging, but and to me highlights the ongoing relevance and need for us to be confronting that and I think especially for white folks to show empathy to what our communities of color have been presented with and had forced upon them in the history of our country. And you know, I think oftentimes it's such a challenging issue for white folks to get so defensive when these issues are discussed, and rather than just don't take it as a personal attack, but just listen, try to understand, try to develop some empathy. And for me, that remains very important. And so those are some of the aspects that are yet kind of driving forces for me as I continue as a community resident, as a neighbor, and servant leader.
Okay. And so I would like for you to define, what is it that you're saying when you say servant leader? How would you define that to someone? What does that look like to you if you're looking for someone to fill that role? Define that for us.
Yeah, I would say that I think that terminology probably comes out of the church and mm-hmm. in the Bible and Jesus' teachings of serving and to kind of lead in that example and not to be an approach where it's a paternalistic one of telling people what they need, what their needs are, and how to do it, but to be there, to listen, to hear what the stated needs are, and to serve by responding to that,
mm-hmm.
and so that's kind of the sense of what that intends.
Okay, so in essence, anyone can be a servant leader within their own circle. So it's not something that is so. High, for lack of a better term, of an office that anyone can't do it. So it just takes one person per household, basically, the type of work that you are talking about and doing. If one person from each household would just step up and be that example of, like, this is how we heal, this is how we move forward, just by listening. All you have to do is listen. So listen and then come to understand what the person is saying. And part of listening, I think that's become an also lost art because, like you said, people are talking. They're having conversations, but they're talking at each other.
Talking at each other, sometimes yelling at each other, and sometimes it's literally, you know, in words. Sometimes, so often it's on social media. And
mm-hmm.
and it's just made it, as much as these formats of technology have allowed us to connect, it's taken away from some of that interpersonal qualities of really interacting more on a personal level. And like you said, really listening and really hearing what a person
right.
is trying to say. And instead of taking a sound bite or a couple, just a phrase and getting all hot and flustered and responding aggressively to that, but
it's like you said, it's an art. And the thing is, if you can't truly have a conversation, you're talking about people that we call we refer to as white, becoming defensive. My take on that, because there's nothing to be defensive about if you've asked a question, and I'm giving you an answer. Now, if you don't like the answer, that's one thing. You don't have to like the answer, but it shouldn't become interpersonal where you feel attacked, because I don't think anyone is actually trying to attack anyone when we have these sensitive conversations. It's about understanding, and you can't move forward until you're willing to have that sensitive conversation and listen and then meet people where they are. And that's the other part, is just meeting people where they are. And I think as a musician, that's something that you practice anyway. So I think that's easier for you to do. People who have to learn music and people who have to work with others who know music or who are learning music, that's something that you're constantly developing on a daily basis. So every time you are in a session with someone, you are listening. So you can know where to meet them, what the issue is, and how to properly address that issue and help them to move forward. So sometimes I think that we forget about those
it's
skills.
It's interesting you make that point. I think it's very well received and on point when you make the parallel of that within musicians in our work, the importance of listening and how that kind of is critical for us to, within an ensemble, for us to
mm-hmm.
make good music. But it's interesting because you have musicians, there are good musicians and bad musicians, and oftentimes bad
mm-hmm.
musicians are the ones that don't listen to other people that they're playing
right.
with. And it's interesting because an appropriate parallel that just as in a conversation, a talking conversation, someone that does not listen gets to be an unpleasant conversation, an unpleasant person to talk to. When you're on the bandstand playing with a musician that's not listening, it's the same dynamic because it makes it tough
mm-hmm.
to make collective music together and to take the audience on a journey because you're not building things together. There's not an interplay going back and forth. So that's great you mentioned that because
mm-hmm.
it's so true.
So I think that it's all about reminding people about this, what they're already doing. They don't realize the parallel. They don't realize that you are already developing something. It's just a matter of, again, like you just said, making the correlation and using it. Everything that we learn, like you said, everything you needed to learn, you learned in elementary school. Kind of true.
mm-hmm.
Where dealing with people is involved. And
yeah.
the primary thing is, how do we work together? And that is what your CD is about, and that is what your community work is about, is how do we work together? So I would challenge, and I'm going to challenge myself also, because I do listen, but there are times, as with anyone, where, to be honest, you have more of a selfish mindset, you know? Things are a little bit more self-centered. And while you hear people, you're not really getting the substance of what's being said, and you're not reading body language to know exactly what the intention is of what was said. So I would say, everyone listening, challenge your group. Challenge your circle. Your circle is whoever you're around on a daily basis to practice listening. So how do you feel about that challenge, Mr. Marcus?
I think that's good. I think that's a good one. You know, I think it would make us better individuals, better people to interact with, and I think that's a good thing.
Okay. And so I especially see that with, again, with children. And I keep going back to children because when I see you and I see some of your posts that you have on Facebook and even when you're at Home Slice, there are children that come out and play and you work so well with them. So I think that's why I keep going back to children.
Mm-hmm.
And then I have also had the opportunity to work with children when I was in the school system. And I keep hearing in passing and sometimes directly how the children are so disrespectful now, and the children are this, the children are that. And my rebuttal always is, well, we fell short. They are the way they are because we allowed it to happen. So all you can do is start to pick up the pieces now. And the next group that you get in front of, the next group of children that find themselves around you, because children are attracted to certain people, they willingly go towards certain people. And so now you have influence over that child. If they're coming to you, you have their ear. You have their heart. You have their mind to some degree. What are you going to drop into their spirit? How are you going to make sure that they become the individual that you want to see on the street or that you want to see in your home? How have you found yourself subconsciously, probably didn't think about it this way, how have you found yourself imparting into the children that come into your program for learning music or even just the arts and crafts or even the gardening for the community?
Well, I think that for us, one of the things that we really try to focus on with our kids is to offer an outlet, an opportunity through our Jubilee Arts program. And mm-hmm. with our different programs that we have here, I sometimes talk about how some of them are responsive type programs and some of them are preventative. Programs like our Martha's mm-hmm. Place program that addresses addiction, and our Strength of Love 2 Farm that offers employment serving our returning citizens from incarceration. Those are responsive type programs. Jubilee Arts is a preventative one where we're offering these opportunities through the arts, oftentimes to our young kids, so that they can have opportunity. And it's a mix. Sometimes through the art mm-hmm. classes, it's just an opportunity for being creative, for self-expression. But also it's an opportunity to cultivate life skills and entrepreneurial skills. And so something that I think about in that regard is our youth in business class, which works with our teenagers, our older kids. And they are an amazing group of young people where they come together mm-hmm. and they work on creating projects, items for sale. So they focus on custom-made T-shirts, ceramic house number signs, jewelry, and they work on budgeting the materials and the project cost, sourcing the materials, building the products, creating the products, and then going out there and selling them, and then they share mm-hmm. the profits. And so for us, that's where we're using art as this medium for cultivating professional skills and entrepreneurial skills and business skills. And so, you know, that's something that we see as significant to how we're supporting and empowering our young people to thrive and not to have to worry later on down the road about some of the challenges that the dangers in our community that we do sometimes lose folks to, whether it's drugs or
right.
some of the violence. And
right.
and you know, this comes back to some of the things we were talking about earlier, people and their stereotypes about our community and others like ours think that, you know, everything is just what they see on The Wire. You know, people that have watched
right.
The Wire, they think that that's all
goodness.
That Baltimore is. And they don't
yes.
understand that we've got wonderful, amazing people. And that even for our folks that are struggling, we're trying to provide that path that just like folks in a well-to-do, affluent community have kind of these routes that are available to them. We're trying to ensure that our folks, whether they're a standout young person or just someone that's kind of struggling, that they can at least have that mm-hmm. opportunity and that access to a path so that they can go into a good, successful life.
Right. And that I truly appreciate is the fact that you all are showing them economics in motion, so how things work, supply and demand. And then out of that, like you said, they split the funds. And so the back end of that is learning how to manage your money, how to manage
oh, yeah.
your personal assets so that as you get older, you put things in the proper perspective. You need to make sure you always have shelter, so you need to budget accordingly. And then everything else falls in line behind that, and you need to make sure you're saving so that you have something when you need to retire or if you hit a rainy day. One of the things I ran into when I was first involved in financial services company, we went and we did a workshop at the ACE Academy, and those kids were so hungry for that information. It was amazing, and I loved the response at the end that we received. But what angered me and motivated me to have such a great presentation for them that day was doing the planning for that. The counselor at that school happened to be someone that I used to work with when I was in the school system, and he said, I want you to actually do a lesson plan for your presentation. Don't just give me a presentation outline. I was like, okay, I'll go ahead and I'll, you know, whip that up. Not a big deal. Well, doing the research for that, I came across information that told me and anybody else who probably would have read it that our children are supposed to or have the opportunity to get financial literacy starting in grade 3. Is that happening? No, it is not. Why isn't it happening? It's not being enforced. Someone in Annapolis didn't care to enforce it. They didn't care if our kids were actually taught that information. So you create these cycles of poverty because you just won't teach the next generation how to be good money managers. And my thing is they're missing the big picture. If you have a person who likes to give, whether they're giving you their last $10 or their last $1,000, they're going to give. So why not allow them to be able to give $1,000 and be okay? You know? So I just was like, this is crazy that someone said, oh, okay, yeah, if you have the curriculum, it's out there. You can go look it up on the web yourself today.
Mm-hmm.
But not be enforced. So I'm very happy to hear that you all are doing that for them, because that is the reason why we have these communities the way that they are. That's a big part of it. All they know how to do is be consumers. They have no clue how to be an investor, how to be a saver, how to pull yourself up out of bootstraps. What bootstraps? They don't even know where to start.
Yeah,
so
I think those are
I greatly appreciate
points. And I think about, oh boy, when I was in high school and getting ready to transition to college, and my dad sat down with me and showed me how to. He set up a checking account for me and showed me how to balance a checkbook and write checks and tend to
mm-hmm.
that. And then years later, he said, Todd, we're going to talk some more about things like managing your money and looking at investment, like putting money away for retirement, even when you're young. And you're right. These are things that, if that's not taught, especially
mm-hmm.
in this day and age where we're in such this instantaneous kind of culture, the notion of saving and managing your funds, if you're not teaching that, it's not something that's reasonable to expect that folks are going to intuitively know that. So I agree with your points. It has to be shared, and you know, happy that we're able to in our youth and business classes to do that, because in addition to the things I mentioned, we also do that with our kids and show them about, like, setting up a bank account and talking about money management and these kind of things, because it's got to be taught. And it's interesting for me to hear you sharing that's something that's supposed to be part of curriculum in schools. It certainly seems like if that was being taken place, that would be a great service across the board.
Yep. And let me tell you, when the curriculum changed for physical education, it ended up falling under a wellness umbrella. So you know how when we came through school, you had health and phys ed, they were like one thing. But now they're actually two separate entities.
Mm-hmm.
So, but under that wellness umbrella, one of the health teachers took sick, went out. So I had the opportunity to actually sit in and teach that health class. And with the new books they got, now this is on high school level though. So it was all inclusive. I love that book. I love that curriculum. My only issue was, why couldn't I have this information for my middle school students?
Mm-hmm.
Because that's when they need to start learning this. And it did touch on, you know, everything from physical health all the way to relationships when you get married. You know, it had the whole wellness paradigm. from beginning to end, and it included consumerism. And so that just made so much sense to me. And it's funny that you say your dad set you down before you went to college and went over how to do a checkbook, because that's actually in that benchmark between grades 9 through 12. One of the benchmarks is going over balancing a checkbook.
Mm-hmm.
And starting to invest, learning investments at that level. And there is some touching on that prior to that as far as balancing a checkbook, but it's just crazy to me. Because these parents can't teach what they don't know, because nobody taught them. I got the bare minimum when I thought about it. The information that I got that had me hungry to learn more, I got from a teacher, my math teacher. She brought in a person that was in investing, and he went over the stock page with us. This was middle school, I remember. And he went over the stock page with us. And after that, I was just like, okay, I got to figure this thing out. I don't know how long it's going to take me to figure this out, but I got to figure this out. I like this, you know. But it's the exposure.
Well, I agree. And you know, you talk about figuring that out for yourself. And, you know, a lot of times people say, well, folks would pull them up by their bootstraps, or people will give examples of someone that's figured it out on their own and saying, well, this person can do it. And that's true. But remember, you know, you've got folks that are super motivated, and you're sharing the example of how you figured that out for yourself. But opportunity should not just be for people that are the standouts or the super motivated
right.
folks. These are, right. you know, we have to look for making sure that everybody is learning information. And so that's where there's that relevance, that for someone that's not paying attention to that, they yet need to have a format where they're exposed to that, introduced to that. And so that's where it becomes even more relevant that, like you're saying, that it's institutionalized in a curriculum and taught broadly
mm-hmm.
so that everybody, whether they're inclined to think about it or not, comes away with some core skills and competencies in important areas like that.
So what is your take on the music curriculum now in the city schools? It seemed to be coming, when I was even in school, it seemed to be, like the rest of the electives, something that was being really looked at as being elective. Like, we could have this, we might not have this next year. What have you seen? Have you been involved with anything in the school system where music is concerned? What's the information you're getting from maybe some of your students?
Yeah, I've not done as much school music education as a lot of my colleagues, but I know that one of the things that is a common theme and challenge is that schools, when there are budget cuts, one of the first things that are lost are the arts programming. And sometimes
mm-hmm.
even that extends to other things, just like whether it's athletics or other extracurricular programs. And so I think you lose out from the well-roundedness that you cultivate for students, and as you're just cultivating young individuals to be adults. So we certainly lose out from that. There are some schools which do, in Baltimore City, that do have some music programs. The Orc Kids program, which is in partnership with the Baltimore Symphony Orchestra, has been one that has really made an intentional effort to try to foster that into a lot of schools which have lost their music programs over the decades. You've got a
mm-hmm.
lot of musicians that do a lot with private lessons. But it's kind of that similar theme that we were talking about with financial literacy and education, that ideally you want to have stuff implemented on the public school level across the curriculum so that everybody across the board is being exposed to this training and information and the benefits that come as a result of that. And I think that as a society we kind of suffer when we don't have folks that are getting that information and getting well-rounded. And it often then also creates a lack of equity and disparity between communities that are wealthier and have still have a lot of these programs and teachings and courses, and those that don't. So, unfortunately, that is a reality that we see here in our city. I can say one of the ways you see it impacted and manifested in our community is that we have marching bands that typically have drums only. And the instruments, the clarinets, the trumpets, the trombones, the wind instruments have been lost from these formats because it's not something that is available to us anymore in so many of our schools. So, you know, it just it highlights the, like I said, the value of when our public education system does incorporate those components to being giving us better, well-rounded citizens and communities.
Is there anything else you would like to let everyone know about, either with your music, community program, with intersection change?
Well, I think the thing I would like want to share is the website so that people can learn more about our work. On the community front, the Intersection of Change website is intersectionofchange.org, and so there you can learn about the different programs that we operate. And then for my music work, the website is toddmarcusjazz.com, and of course we're doing a wonderful CD release concert this Saturday, June 16th at 8 p.m. over at Baltimore Center Stage. So, you know, that'll be an exciting one for us. And, you know, encourage people to check out those websites and reach out and be in touch. And from those websites, you can link to all of our social media pages as well.
Okay. And then you have two other locations for this concert this week and weekend, just in case people aren't in the Baltimore area.
Saturday, the June 16th, we'll be here in Baltimore at Baltimore Center Stage, and then we drive up to Rochester, New York, for a concert on Sunday at Bob Shop Records. That's in Rochester, New York. And then coming up in September, we're going to be doing performances in Connecticut, in Buffalo, in Cleveland, in New York, Philadelphia. So we've got a longer tour of to promote this album, On These Streets, in September.
Okay. And then the one in D.C. is on Friday?
That actually got canceled because of some logistic challenges.
Okay.
So that one will not be happening, unfortunately.
Okay. All right. So
but I will
remember,
be tonight if our D.C.
tonight?
Listeners are looking for some music, I'll be with a great pianist named Harry Appleman in D.C. tonight, June 13th. Doing a concert that's part of the D.C. Jazz Festival, and that will be at the Anacostia Playhouse at 7:30 p.m. So, again, all that's up on my website, toddmarcusjazz.com.
Okay, and that's toddmarcusjazz.com. Okay, folks? So make sure you get on there. Make sure you look it up. Go by, check out some of the activities that are taking place at Intersection of Change. Support the music because the music supports this cause. And check out his earlier works also. I really like Inheritance a lot, so I do play that one a lot. I think most of my guests at the Security Boulevard location have probably heard the CD at least two or three times in my rotation. So, yeah, they'll probably be hearing this one too quite a bit. So, in any case, I thank you very much for coming on today. I thank you for your time. I thank you for the time that you're putting into the community. And even though you weren't born and raised here, you're no longer an outsider. Once you have 20 plus years somewhere, you are now a resident there. Okay,
I'm a Baltimorean now.
You are a Baltimorean. You are not an outsider. So, there's a whole another two generations of people know who you are, sir. You've been in that community for two generations.
Yeah.
So, again, thank you very much. And it is Wednesday, so I just want to remind everyone, Wednesday nights we have Home Slice, 8 p.m. to 11, House Band employees from 8 to 9, Open Jam, 9 to 11. Remember, that's the Home Slice that is on Charles Street. And then we have Trinacria, the third Tuesday of the month. So for June, that would be the 19th. So make it out there if you can. It starts at 7:30, and runs till about 10. So hope to see you all out there. Thank you for being on again, and I will speak to you all next week.